All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're up to almost, I guess it is our penultimate event, the web lecture. This is an integral part of every fall meeting, named after James Webb, really the father of the National Academy of Public Administration. And we try to reserve it for somebody that's going to bring you some really thought-provoking, innovative ideas about public administration, and today is no exception. But I'm not the introducer of the speaker. The introducer of the speaker is Kay Goss. So I want to invite Kay up to introduce our speaker for today.
Thank you so much, Terry, for this honor. I really appreciate it. I was thinking, I'm celebrating my fifth anniversary as a NAPA fellow. And as I was thinking back over my career as a student and as a professor and as a public administrator, I wanted to not tell my age, but to give you an idea. My first course in public administration, textbook was An Introduction to Public Administration by Lewis Brownlow. And during the time I was taking that course, Mr. Brownlow passed away. That gives you an idea how long I've been in the business. With the James E. Webb lecture, it's a very special, as Terry mentioned, part of the annual conference. And this year, particularly profound in our speaker. For those of you who are not as old as I am, James E. Webb was budget administrator for President Truman and also Under Secretary of State for President Truman. And then he became President Kennedy's first administrator of NASA, and President Johnson also kept him on for that. So innovation and the Intersector Project are a very important part of his legacy. Now, to tell you about Frank Weil, our speaker today, I must say, first of all, he's a legend on the Harvard University campus, especially the Kennedy School, and his background is he has a bachelor's and a law degree from Harvard University, and he is chairman of the Abacus Associates and a senior partner at Ginsburg, Feldman, Weil, and Bress. He was assistant secretary and head of the International Trade Administration under the U.S. Department of Commerce, and chief financial officer at Payne Weber and general partner at Loeb Rhodes. He's a current or past trustee for and board member for GEICO, the Asian Society, the Smithsonian Institute, the Center for National Policy, and the Council for Excellence in Government, and the Education Alliance. So this is a devoted, selfless man who has led through all these. Now, at Harvard and at the Kennedy School, he founded the Mosvar Romani Center for Business and Government, which is housed at Whale Hall, and founded the Collaborative Governance Program at Harvard. And so I know from that short bio that you think he's a really serious man at all times. And I found some evidence that that's not the case. I read some of his Twitter comments, and his Twitter comment on the World Series last year, when I first read it, I thought he was talking about the World Series this year. But I want to quote Frank on that subject. He says, "A very few who saw Sunday night's game through the end were alive in 1951. Let's relive the contest between the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers in the final playoff game for the National League pennant. The Giants were at bat, behind by two runs in the bottom of the ninth, and there were two runners on base and two outs, and Bobby Thompson was at bat with the great Ralph Branca pitching, and the count got to 3-2, and the odds at the moment that the Giants could win were 5,765,000,000 843,242. You can tell Frank took statistics sometime in his career. Against. That's right. Pranka threw and Thompson swung and the ball left the park completely. And the Giants won 5-4. And it took over 50 years, Frank says, for enough people to not ever know or forget that moment. And now we have an equally memorable game to stimulate interest in baseball for another 100 years. Diamonds are forever. And I say, Frank is forever. Frank, come join us.
Work. Well, I'm really tickled to be here. Terry got me out of the blue several months ago and suggested I do this, and I said yes because I felt at the time that this organization, which it had had reached out to me not long before, I can't remember exactly when, to include me in your ranks, which I find is an honor, because I didn't really qualify because I was never a civil servant. And I think all of you all, how many people in this room were not civil servants? Oh, really? So what's the distinction between...
Contributions to the field.
Well, I mean, that's why I qualify on that. Okay. I also hadn't really connected it before, but Jim Webb and what he did with NASA is right square in the middle of the target of what interests me, because NASA was more than anything else an organization which brought together all the sectors. But I thought I'd do a little trick. I want to make this informal, amusing. I'd like to inspire a few people to go out and repeat the thoughts that we're going to talk about here today. So I want to start out by asking this group to give me an idea as to how many people think which of the following three sectors are the most important sectors in the United States. Automobile sector, how many hands? This may not work. real estate sector. Two? Three? Okay. Agricultural sector. Four, five, whatever it is. Okay. Well, the answer is all of you are wrong, because there's only one sector that matters, and that's the inner sector, which you see right here. We've done a little research with no success as to how it came to be that society is organized on three legs: government, not-for-profit, and for-profit. The evidence that's available says that this goes back not just hundreds of years, but thousands of years. Somehow human beings organized themselves into those three sectors. The words were a little bit different as you go back in time, but this is the way it was: government of some sort, not-for-profit, educational, hospitals, et cetera, and for-profit. You heard my background. I didn't plan it that way, but it was a multi-sector background. I began to see when I was in the Commerce Department that one of the problems we had was we had a hard time getting the sectors we had to deal with. Because being the Commerce Department, we were more related to the private, for-profit sector. And the sectors speak different languages, have different cultures, different everything. And they tend not to trust each other, and they often tend to, does this resonate with some of you, to train the people they're dealing with not to trust the other sectors. Now, if that isn't the recipe for failing to unravel problems, I don't know what is. And so that's been our basic problem. I should look at my notes at some point here. So now, here we go. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Thank you, Tim. The intersector is simply a term which, amusingly enough, is not in the dictionary. And as a result, every time I type it, it comes up red. and you would have thought it literally is not in the dictionary. Other forms of it may be. And the intersector is where the sectors come together, or they can come together and should come together. How many of you were in the how many in this room ever did anything besides government work?
Well,
almost everybody. How many of you of that group were in what we call the for-profit private sector? Quite a few. How many in the room were in the not-for-profit sector? More. Well, maybe some of you were in both. Does the notion that these sectors don't know each other, don't understand each other, don't like each other, does that notion resonate with you? Hands. Sort of, but not by everybody. Okay. What happened, which caused me to think about this, was I had had some experiences when I was in the Commerce Department that if we could get people together and talk about problems, we could get them to resolve things. And one of the experiences we had involved the Kennedy School, who sent some people to Jamestown, New York. How many people know where Jamestown is? Plenty. Northwest corner of New York State, 40,000 people. Shoes, baseball bats, and furniture. Unemployment rate at this point 15 years ago was about 30%, and they were in big trouble. And they asked for some help, and these fellows at the Kennedy School that I'd been involved with went up there, and they got a meeting of 18 people from Jamestown, six from the city government, six from the unions, and six from the business community, and they met, and the first thing they did in the meeting, typically, is they went around the room, and everybody identified themselves, and when they finished doing that, it turned out that only three of the 18 people from Jamestown had ever been in the same room before. At the end of the day, they had a good conversation. The guys from Jamestown told the guys from Harvard, you can go home, because we know we got a problem. We know we want to do something about the problem. And now that we've met and we can talk, we'll make some progress. And they made some progress. And the unemployment rate in Jamestown today is 12%, which only proves that some of these problems are intractable because it's very hard to get create jobs in faraway communities that were based upon old industrial habits. So that the fact is that that experience, coupled with one I had personally in New York, had a back operation, and the doctor told my wife to take me out and walk me around in Central Park, which we live next to. Walking around the park, this was in circa 1982, 3, 4, I can't remember the year now, I said to my wife, gee, this park is great. Last we saw it, which was in 75, 6, before I came to Washington, and it was a sewer. What happened? And so I began to look into it. I see a man nodding back there. You were involved with that?
I think I know the story, but I'll keep quiet.
Okay. Oh, no, you can tell it.
It's a great story.
Anyway, I started looking into it, what I discovered was a bunch of rich people, not surprisingly, both Fifth Avenue and Central Park West, were tired of the fact that the park was in such bad shape, and they formed something called the Central Parks Conservancy. And then they got hooked up with the Parks Department. One of the things they agreed on was that together with the Parks Department, they would have shared discretion over certain changes in the rules of how the parks were used or not used. And out of that grew the restoration of the parks. And I said, well, that's fascinating. And I went and talked to my friends at the Kennedy School at that point. And out of that came a book, which if you haven't seen, you may want to have a look at. It's not a great book, but it makes the point well. They came up with the title Collaborative Governance. And there, because those sectors collaborated, and the parks, and any of you all know the Central Park area at all? Is now definitely revitalized and very attractive. Now, the point I want to make, and I want to move fairly quickly to a point where you all can ask questions, because I think I judge myself to be a better answerer of questions than making of formal speeches. But the fact is that one of the problems we have, and I think you all know this problem as well as I do, certainly Tim Clark does, is that there's a big schism between policy and process. And in this town, if you're not identified with a policy that's important to people, particularly journalists, forget it, because if you start talking about how things work, no interest. Now, again, I'll ask a question. How many people in the room think process is as important or more important than policy? Well, there we go. Well, this is a big step in the right direction. Well, now, get ready to go to work, because I'm not going to get a good answer to this question, but somebody hopefully will come up with an answer to the question. Process is how you make things happen. You create a policy through a process. You implement a policy through a process. If you don't have a process, you don't get the policy and you don't implement it. It's a chicken and egg problem, which has been anybody disagree with the fact that generally speaking in Washington, if you're not identified with an objective like clean air or whatever it is, you don't have anything of interest to the world at large? Is that right or wrong? Terry is shaking her head.
You might not want the world at large to be
interested. Well, that's quite right. But the fact is, the only way you get change is if you get people aware of it. Because if we could get people to understand the difference from policy and process, and get people to believe that there isn't, and they even know there's an intersector, much less what the relevance of it is, you could get people to begin to, as they did in Jamestown, sit down and talk. And when I first started working with this, if you have a look at the intersector website, you'll see that we have a bunch of cases, all backward-looking, because that's all that was available at that time, and a toolkit. And I thought if people, intelligent people, read that, you wouldn't have to do much to get them to do it, use it, because the first rule of that toolkit is if you have a problem, whatever it is, the sanitation department, you name it, and at all levels, not maybe more at the lower levels even than the higher levels, if you've identified the problem and identify the people who are involved with the problem, and you sit down and start talking, you're much more likely to come up with a solution. How many people in the room know the name Robert Putnam? A lot. Good. Putnam became a good friend of mine, and we used to have long talks in Switzerland and other places. I'm a great admirer of his, but he has never really come up with an answer to how to solve the problem he identified. And I said to him way back, and this is in a sense what I've been doing for the last number of years, I said, the best thing you can do is get a big mirror and hold it up and show it to the world. If they see it, they'll believe it involves themselves. But he's never really found the right way to do that. And maybe it's impossible. And maybe what we're trying to do by calling attention to the fact that the intersector is where the action really is or really should be, it must be, it will be very slow to happen. So we are agnostic about where and topics because it applies. I've never found an issue or place where if you applied these principles, it couldn't work. And so we're working on that. Let me go on with the slides. Whoop. Doesn't want to change. There's a clicker. Oh, here. Oh, there's a... There we go. Got myself tangled up in a lot of paper. All right, I'm going to... Look at that, it's almost a half an hour. Longer than I normally talk. I think we all agree, you wouldn't be here if we didn't, that there are problems with how government operates in today's world. And I don't mean politically. I mean, it's been made worse by current events. I'm going to really summarize this here. A good slogan we could all adopt, and we can give Mr. Webb the credit and Terry the credit for having let it start here, is a slogan that we can start using, is the future of government is governance. Governance is, you liked it. Anybody else like it? Well, we got 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Governance is the process, going back to process and policy, process of governing a modern society. The term is used in the corporate world, and it's used other places, but it is what embraces all the various elements that have to go into it. And I've tried to confine work of our organization to that simple idea, because we got to convert a lot of people, including the folks in this room, as well as a lot of journalists, and my friend Tim Clark's going to take the lead in that, maybe, that it's worth an effort to get people to say, there's merit in that idea, and to try to get more people aware of the fact that the recipe for not solving problems is not to talk to people about problems. And that's what we mainly have today. And again, I'm not talking about the current events with this current administration. So that's the outline of my thinking. My experience, which I didn't plan, took me through all three sectors at the state level and at the federal level. Because I've asked myself, how did I do anything as dumb as to get interested in a subject like this where you have to keep pushing that boulder uphill, and if you don't keep pushing, it's going to roll back and roll you into a pancake. Questions? Yes. Oh, good. You're going to come up.
Frank, I don't want to even begin to stop you from explaining and describing what I think the future of what we're going to have to deal with, what is. My question to you is, and I wish you would say more, because I think your work is right on target. And if we're going to solve problems in the 21st century, we're going to have to adopt your thinking. My question to you is the decentralization that's occurring at an incredibly rapid pace within our government, and I think it's international, and it's being accelerated by the age that we're in, the information age. Do you think that is a sufficient force to start mobilizing us to operate in this way? Because we've moved away from this approach over the last, in my view, over the last half century, and we need to move back to this way. Will decentralization, information, what are the forces that are going to start us to move in this direction?
That's a very good question. First of all, I would say, and I don't know, I'd be interested what the reaction in this room is, that the Internet and social media have been counter forces because it enables everybody to have their view and go into that sound box and talk at people, not with people. So I think the social media is further fractionating the world we live in. Now, what can we do about that is maybe we have to get to a point where the problems become so acute that we get to the edge of some kind of a modern-day civil war. You can't envision a civil war of the sort that we had in 1860 because that was along geographic lines. The problem is there's no line, and that's like the way the world is. But when we come to the point that people do the kinds of things that we see more and more of now, people will at some point say, enough, I hope, I think. But we're not there yet. And so I don't really have an answer to your question, but I think you raise a very good point, which is social media, in theory, should have brought more people together because it's easier to talk to people. But maybe there's a series of stages you've got to go through to get to that point. But we're not there yet. Would you agree with that?
Well, we haven't really started yet.
Well, that may be. But the people who operate the social media, such as Facebook, et cetera, they want to be hands-off. They don't think they should tell people what to do.
Frank, I have a question here.
No, let him go ahead.
You go ahead.
I just raised information as a terminology for an age where
people could have information. My question is, we're decentralizing activity in the country, and that's happening politically, it's happening economically, and it's happening socially. And will that decentralization and pushing the problems to levels where they can be solved, will that movement and that change, will that start us, do you think, to start acting the way that you're describing, the way government operates and the way the other sectors operate?
Well, in theory...
What's going to move us?
Well, I don't want to give a flip answer. I'm not sure that works because I think people have to be more oriented towards looking for a solution. I mean,
right.
The Jamestown example is the one I would point to. Once they've discovered that they know they got a problem, and they know they want to do something about it, and then they started to talk. And Jamestown is a wonderful example because it hasn't worked great, but it's better than the alternative.
Well, then what you are saying with the Jamestown example, if that epitomizes your thinking, that solving problems in a decentralized level is going to force us to operate in the way you're talking about.
It should move in that direction. Yes, I agree with that. But that's a very, very important question. Tim.
Frank, if I understand you correctly, you are saying that all three sectors should be working more together, but I'm wondering about what you can say about the civic impulse, to put it one way, of corporations, of private sector corporations, which are highly regulated, which are profit motivated, which don't often do things that don't often spend money and do things that aren't in the interest of their shareholders. That's one question. And then secondly, on the philanthropic side of things, the nonprofit, that sector, There's a new book just published two or three months ago about how the major philanthropists in this country tend to be narrowly focused on projects of interest to them and not sufficiently supportive of the role of government, which is by far the most powerful force in doing good and regulating and creating the conditions for a prosperous and equitable society, not sufficiently supportive of the role of government in solving our problems. Those are two different but related questions.
Well, we're all familiar with the expression government is the problem, not the solution. And that is partially right. In the sense that when government officials, and we were all one at some sort or another at one point, tend to go into a discussion feeling either a big pocket full of change or with a big club in their hand saying, this is how you're going to do it. I'll tell you an anecdote I had. At one point, my deputy, who was supposed to be handling the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, was away, and I had to deal with the companies that were worried about. It wasn't actually the Foreign Corrupt Practices; it was a regulation of imports, and the price of steel, scrap steel, had gone from its range of 40-ish to 140-ish in about two or three months, and they came in these heads of all these scrap steel type companies and said, we want you to regulate and limit the importation of scrap because that put the price down. And I said to these guys, well, I'll think about it, but I have to tell you, I think you're probably wrong. And I said, by the way, I think this is an interesting example of something here. I am a quite liberal Wall Streeter telling you guys, businessmen from the Midwest, that you're wrong. And the reason I think you're wrong is I think what we should be telling the world is we're not going to do any regulation of imports, and the price will come down. And they were really angry, and they left angry. And so the next day we announced we were going to not do that, and the price fell from 140-something back to 40 in about three or four weeks. And I got a letter sometime later, and I've been looking for that letter ever since, and I can't find it, from the head of one of these companies saying, when we met you, we thought you were the most arrogant son of a bitch we'd ever met, but you were right. That was one of the more gratifying moments I had in the government. Now, what was your second question? Well, but if he's the same guy that I think you're referring to, he's the guy on the television all the time asking to impeach Trump for this. That would, because Trump's not going to do it, that we know, and his administration's not going to. So if you try to do too much, you don't do much. And one of the reasons we've stayed very tightly focused on the process of governance is because we got to get more people, and hopefully you all will have some ideas, and anybody who'd like to get involved, my colleague Neil Britto, where is he? Is sitting over here. We would love to hear from you. You can get us through our website and put you to work in some way. But we want to get the message out. Now, we've succeeded in some ways more than we expected at this point. It's slow because people are involved with what is on their mind, and they don't have room for or time for a lot of new things. So I wouldn't be too quick to criticize the not-for-profit people who are focused, because from the way they see it, I think Sire is an interesting guy from what just we've seen on television. But I think his notion of trying to impeach Trump is weird because it ain't going to happen. We all know that because of the Senate. What's he going to? And moreover, if we did impeach Trump, we get Pence, and that might be worse. I didn't mean to get into politics, but there we are. How can you avoid it today?
Good morning. Thank you. Many of us, if not most of us, were taught in our earliest classes about POSDECORB. And POSDECORB, POSDECORB, the POSDECORB, you know, the how to manage the essential elements of public administration.
Spell the word. I couldn't hear it.
It's an acronym, POSDECORB. POSDECORB? Planning, organizing, directing, staffing, coordinating.
Oh.
I don't know.
Somehow that eluded me. I don't know how.
Got him. All right. Well, then my question's not going to work because the question was, so many of us in the room were taught about these core management ideas, and these were the tools for managing government and government organizations. And the question, I think, and when we're thinking about the big challenges facing administration is, how do we change that acronym? Because we're still teaching this acronym in many of our public administration courses.
I first have to learn it.
Yeah, right. I throw it out then. Because the issue is, many of those ideas, at some level, they're still present. But do we need a new kind of organizing acronym that more effectively captures the need for coordination across sectors? Coordinating, is that really communicating? And you're talking about kind of information flows, but to what extent do we need different ways of understanding information? What kind of data do we need? Instead of directing, do we need data? So we have all these new forces that are around us, and the question is, what's the new acronym that's better than POSDECORB for the 21st century to guide not just government, but the intersector? What is it that we can all work around?
I'm glad to learn about whatever that thing is called. But I've got it, I think, which is, let's talk about governance, which causes people to say, what do you mean by that? Which is, it's a process of governing a modern society, which means we work together. It's better than intersector. There's several schools of public policy that are in the process of changing their name from schools of public policy to schools of governance. And if we could get that one word change, we could get some progress in that.
Using the Jamestown example, I think of something a mayor once told me, and that is the virtues in the asking. So you ask a group of people, as you suggested in Jamestown, they came together and at a micro level to deal with a problem. How do you extrapolate that to large groups? Because it's the personal part that made that process work. You got however many people, they got to know each other, and then they were able to make some decisions collectively once they got to know each other. How do you do that on larger issues with larger groups that are representing, you know, a whole industry, for example?
Actually, it's relatively simple. It involves what the people in Jamestown said. Once you get people together, and I'll give you another example of this in a minute, and they can say to themselves, yes, we know we have a problem. Yes, we want to do something about it. Now we can start to talk. And that can be, why does our Congress have a lot of committees and subcommittees? For that reason, but they're not using it now. I mean, look at this intelligence subcommittee in the House with this fellow Nunes. I mean, they haven't talked, and they stop each other from talking. The hearings on Kavanaugh, for example, is the same kind of thing. So there's no desire to try to bridge the gap. And so that's why we have to talk about governance, which is, do your job in the and by the way, I think the Democrats are to some extent as guilty of not cooperating, collaborating, as the Republicans in some cases. And I noticed recently that Pelosi, I don't mean to get political, I know I'm not supposed to, Pelosi is the least popular of our leaders in the country today, yet if we win the House back, she's going to claim the credit and try to remain as Speaker. That would be a shame because we need new leadership. One of the biggest charges being, I heard my Republican friends, and I have plenty of them, they say, well, the problem with you guys is you don't have a candidate and you don't have a policy. And if you think about it, the Democrats have not come up with much except the normal things. So how do you do it? The answer is you convince people that they have a duty to participate in government, governance. And I think that captures everything. And so if everybody left this room thinking that there's something in that and started talking about that with their neighbors and stuff, that would be a great thing. Go ahead.
For you. Who decides and how do you decide who has a seat at the table?
Well, that's you're talking about human relationships. In the case of Jamestown, somebody, I don't know who it was, picked the six for the three different sectors. And if you have, I'm sorry to be political about it, if you have somebody like the majority leader of the Senate, you got a problem because they pick the people who don't want to do anything. But one of them, Terry, is it all right? I mean, I'm in this deep, I may as well go all the way.
I'll audit the recording later.
Okay. There are more women candidates in running for Congress this year than ever. There's a congressman named Seth Moulton from the Massachusetts 6th District, some of you may have heard of. More of you should hear him. He has all the qualities of being a real leader. He went to the Kennedy School at Harvard. He was in the Marines, et cetera. He backed this year, I think, 22 or 3 candidates for the House. And one of them, for example, is a woman who has 4 children. She was 10 years Marine Corps pilot of helicopters in combat. And she's the most amazing woman I've ever met. And she's going to get elected. And there's a bunch more like that. And I think this is not political. I think young people and women are our solution. Because us old guys we didn't do it. And I'm not accusing anybody in this room of lying down on the job, but we just didn't do it. Anybody disagree with that?
Do you see a way to use the internet and other means to actually get the voice of the people? Half the people vote in the primaries. It's what, a quarter of the people vote. I don't think anyone thinks their voice is heard. And I think,
well, for example, I tried to get Bloomberg recently to buy some ads across the country saying one thing. The young people of America are the people that should vote the most, and they vote the least. And that doesn't make any sense because the future is theirs. Vote. We know there's some evidence to show that there's they may be a sleeper in this election. It's a little early to really have any strong idea, but the sleeper may be that it turns out that there are going to be a lot more young people voting than would have ever voted in a midterm election. Or at all, like a lot. I mean, like almost 3 times what it was in the past. And the same applies to people of my age, the group 19 to 29 and the group 69 and above may combine to produce about 3 to 4% more Democratic voters than any prior midterm election. And there's a lot of close races, including Texas, et cetera. So that may be part of it. But the people who we are looking at in charge today are not going to do this. And my solution to that is we got to do something about it in the ballot box. And we all got a chance. I mean, I don't give a damn who you guys vote for, but I have to believe most of you vote right, whatever that is. If you think it's right with me.
I want to move from Jamestown to your Central Park Conservancy notion of intersectoral. And it's, I thought it was a great example. And as you know, there are probably 50 parks in New York City that have some working contributions.
And there's some parks in Chicago that are doing the same thing.
That's interesting. So, I mean, there are issues with it. The parks in poor neighborhoods where you're not going to get it's harder to get that kind of thing. You've got to deal with some equity issues. But do you see that, at least in some range of functional areas, museums or things local government does, is that kind of a model of, and it's a real blended workforce, as you point out.
No, absolutely it's a model.
Excuse me?
It's absolutely a model. And people will say, well, look at this and look at that. And you can find enough exceptions to say, well, it doesn't really mean it. But I've never found anybody who said talking to people about solving common problems cannot be bad. I've never heard anybody say collegiality or collaboration is a bad thing. But they don't, again, that's process. They want a policy. We've got to clean up the air. And I'm all for all those things. But we have to start by spreading the notion, and I think maybe the process policy point, maybe the, let me, and I take questions as long as they let me. I enjoy answering questions. I mentioned Bob Putnam a while ago. He did his thesis at Harvard a long time ago on how the regions compared to our states in Italy fared on socioeconomic activities versus one another. And they were looking for things in were done differently around Italy. And they came up with one variable that correlated with better versus not so good. And that one variable was, guess what? And it stumped them for months. Choral societies, singing groups. Well, it turns out singing groups don't discriminate between anybody. People like to sing, all sizes, tall, short, fat, thin, women, men, whatever. And guess what? And what does singing have to do with collaboration in making things work? Well, the answer is, guess what those people did after they sang together, you know, once every couple of weeks? They would go out and have a glass of wine, and they get friendly, and they know each other. And then they had a problem with the sanitation department, and they knew that Joe was doing it, and they solved their problem. And the correlation was not having anything to do with the music. It had to do with they knew each other. They not only trusted each other, they also knew each other. And that also has been found subsequently. The soccer leagues, everything else, bowling leagues. You have a question.
Thank you, Frank. I wanted to ask you what you think about some of these models of leadership that are emerging now. We have a lot of public-private partnerships that are becoming a model for financing and collaborating on major public works projects. The National Capital Region up here has a lot of buildings and projects and infrastructure that were built through public-private partnerships, shared financing, collaboration on land and space. And related to that, I'm wondering what you think of the adaptive leadership model that has come out of Harvard, Ron Heifetz's work, kind of understanding the need for adaptation, the need to bring outcomes of government better in line with public values. And if you see that model and perhaps the public-private partnership approach to things as one way of getting at some of the objectives you've had of focusing on governance.
I'm not that knowledgeable about this, the last thing you mentioned. But it's clearly aimed in the right direction because this is all about adaptation. So I think I like that. I am not a big fan of the so-called public-private partnerships because I think they are basically, and this is a too broad a brush, I grant, fig leaves because they are used to say, okay, we're doing something. You see these things on roads about organizations that are contributing to making the something on the roadside things cleaned up. The term corporate social responsibility, that means something to you? that is the fig leaf of all fig leaves. Because it's covering up nothing. So there are people are using ways, and basically it's corporations that want to say that they're doing the right thing, but not to be obliged to do anything really about it. People say, well, you're just saying that because they're competing with you. And they're not competing with us. They're offering a much thinner gruel. I'm not opposed to them. They're in some ways aimed at the right problem, but they're going about it in a way which tends to relieve the need to do the problem better. Thank you. My goodness.
Hi, I'm Jack Knott. I'm the dean of the Price School of Public Policy at University of Southern California.
Which school?
The Price School of Public Policy Price. At the University of Southern California.
Who was Price?
Yeah. Saul Price was the founder of Price Club, and then it eventually became Costco.
It was Price Club because of not the meaning of the word, but it was his name.
Yes, his name, yeah.
I never knew that.
It's the Price family. And they care a great deal about this, especially as it is applied to urban, low-income, poverty issues. They've done a lot of work with government and the private sector, but that's not what I stood up here to talk to you about.
No, but I'd love for you to talk to my colleague Neil Brito over here, so Neil will catch you before.
Why they gave us this major gift. Fund our school in part, but
is he still living?
No, he passed away, so he's not still living. But his children still actively support the school and are engaged in this. So, but what I wanted to raise with you is we actually have a consortium. So I think out west this is a pretty big deal already. There's a tremendous amount of focus on governance and intersector problem solving. I don't know if it's more than out east, but it's a big deal out west, and it's a very common occurrence. And so several schools out west have formed a consortium, public policy schools, around collaborative governance. That's actually the name of the consortium.
That's the name of
the consortium. And it includes the University of Washington, the Evans School. And that school has just changed its name, by the way, to Public Policy and Governance, just so you should know. I think that's the case.
I think I've heard of this, yes.
Yeah, and it involves the Price School of Public Policy at USC. It involves the University of Arizona. In Arizona, in Tucson. It also involves the University of Colorado, Denver. And we're admitting now this year, our first time, our Eastern partners, the Maxwell School, Syracuse, has just joined this consortium as well.
We'd like to join.
Well, that was my question. I don't know that much about this intersector initiative project, but I just wondered if there's some collaboration or something that could be done that between our consortium and this project?
The answer is absolutely yes. My board of the Intersector Project, which has been very helpful, not with money, but with good ideas, been after me for 2 or 3 years. I'm 87. And they said, you better get somebody at the get involved besides Neil, who we all think is great. So I was looking around for some place to associate with, which would sort of institutionalize. And we've been having an extensive conversation with the University of Maryland, which is more or less the equivalent there as what you are in California. It depends on how academic your school is. If you're really, truly academic, you will have some trouble with what we want to do, because we're so exclusively focused on process. I want to see cyber problems solved. I want to see all the problems solved. But our mission, and I'm keeping tightly focused on it, is the process that can be done through everything else. And, but so we're now focusing on institutionalizing in a different way. And it turns out Don Kettle at Maryland, who's now gone where, Neil?
LBJ,
Who was very early on a lot of these ideas. I didn't invent these things. I discovered them. But they had Kettle was talking about governance 15, 20 years ago. Is that date right? I don't want to make a Trump mistake. But we want to work with every place like yours, and would love to be part of it.
Good afternoon, sir.
That's a bad start. Before you start, I went to Exeter years ago, and there was a very famous a man who talked, and we had a Sunday night talk at Exeter, and his name was Franklin P. Adams, he in the middle of his early part of his talk, some kid looked at his watch, He said, I don't mind it when somebody looks at their watch once. But when they look at their watch a second time, I figure I better wind it up. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. No, I only looked at my watch to be sure that it was afternoon as opposed to morning, so that when I greeted you, I did it properly. Once again, sir, thank you very much for your wonderful and insightful presentation today. For your leadership that brought you to where you are, and one of the reasons, no less, why Madam President of this Academy asked you to be the principal speaker for this occasion. I am Arnold Fields, and yesterday we talked about the future of government, or what will government look like in 2040, year 2040. That's not the question to which I am going to ask you to respond, sir. But you alluded to age, youth, as perhaps the future of governance in our world, needless to say. And you alluded to the social media as probably a leg iron to that in some respects. That may not be what you meant, but that's how I took what you said.
A leg iron?
A leg iron, meaning it is an inhibiting thing as opposed to an advancing thing.
I couldn't hear your word.
Leg iron.
Leg iron.
Leg iron.
I got it.
You know, I
never had
folks
one, but that's
in jails have, yes. So my question, sir, is since I was raised in a poor family. My mother had no more than a fourth grade education, and my father the same. I have capitalized on the opportunities that this great country has brought me for now 72 years. I have
You're just getting started.
Sir?
You're just getting started.
Exactly, sir. There we go. I've been privileged to serve in relatively high-level positions within this government, and I've had great leaders along the way, which is really what has really brought me to where I am as opposed to a unilateral effort on Arnie Fields' behalf. But I think, though, that everything I really needed to know, I learned it in the home from my parents with no more than a fifth grade education. So my question to you, sir, since we are depending upon our youth to move us through the rest of this century or perhaps even the millennium, what is the future of the family and their role in the future of nations? Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I mean, that's a very provocative, very good, very tough question, because the nature of the family has surely changed and maybe accelerated because of social media. I happen to have four children and nine grandchildren and six great-grandchildren, so I'm a proponent of family. And I will also say I've learned something else, which some of you may have had this experience. Your grandchildren are much more responsive to your ideas about what they do with their children than your children are, because your children have lots of criticism about what you did or didn't do with them. So they say, stay away from telling us how to deal with your grandchildren. So everybody who's got any choice in the matter, go for having great-grandchildren. I think the family is a very interesting question. What did you do? What was your most recent job before you? I assume you retired.
I can only say that I'm semi-retired because I served a full career in the United States Marine Corps, from which I retired after 35 years and about 13 years ago.
That explains why you're so fit.
And subsequent to that, I've been working for the federal government, State Department, Department of Defense, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, and a whole list of other things to which I have been privileged. So that has been my legacy, or is my legacy, sir, from a governmental work point of view.
You still active?
I am. I am currently working for the Department of Defense in support of a commission overseeing the Vietnam War commemoration under the Secretary of Defense.
Let me turn your question back to you. What do you think about the role of the family in all this?
Well, sir, I don't have children.
I'm sorry.
So, but I respect and admire all families who do have children because I'm a product of one.
Right on your left is the mother of my four children. Right there, next to you.
But what do I think about the future of the family? Is that what you're asking me, sir?
You asked me. I'm asking you.
Yes, sir. I think the family is an important piece of humanity, and I think we are all here to talk about it today because somehow we have been able to rise above the challenges of the family, and we have maintained enough of what the substance of a family needs to be in order to advance governance and nations and our own basic existence. So I think it's a very important factor, but I find that in today's culture, we tend to allow the external community to take on more of the responsibility of the family than the family central leadership, the parenting piece of it itself, sir. That's how I look at it. So I think we need to go back to my day when the family was the root of the community. It was basically the root of everything that we did during those days. And I do think that somehow we've gotten away from that, and I think we have created a number of issues that are very challenging as a result of it, sir.
Totally agree with you, and it's not a subject I've thought about much, although I do think about family a lot for other reasons. But I think you make a good point, and it does have a bearing on what we're talking about here. So thank you for your thoughts. Terry?
Well, Frank, I want to thank you very much for reminding us, I think, in that whole conversation that progress and governance is not something we can relegate to technology, that it requires sort of an old school human interaction. And we need to get back to the concept of social capital in all of these different aspects if we hope to move governance and problem solving forward. So I'm expecting that as we get into the grand challenges conversation over the coming year, that the tools in the intersector toolkit that Frank's got are actually going to be really fundamental in helping us to address the real big problems that we plan to lay on the table. So I hope you'll join me one more time in a round of applause for Frank. Thank you.
I forgot one thing.